or who are not from any of the villages in the region. So those Native peoples, their rights in that's a word we're not going to use anymore, right? Anyway, that's an issue I think that needs to be clarified. But the one point that I do want to make is that a movement that I see in the state is that the state is beginning to contract with regional associations to administer services. And you know, from the one study that I did on the economic status of Native women, it was very clear that when regional associations administered programs, that there was a greater percent of Native hire and local hire. So we do see the state moving towards contracting health and social service kind of programs to regional associations. So I'm just, I just don't know about the life of, what do you see in store for our regional associations or nonprofits?
I see a very definite need for a regional organization. For us, it's traditional. As a group of tribal entities, we've been meeting that way for centuries, coming together and having our meetings and making decisions as a unified group when there was those necessities. And I see a continuing need for regional groups for purposes of strength, for purposes of unity, for purposes of making those decisions that will affect all of us. That are outside the community itself. Anything that unifies us does give us strength. And it gives us an opportunity for those things that we disagree in. We can do that in-house. We can clean our dirty laundry in-house and come out with a unified decision-making process so that people can't tear us apart using one against the other. The services aspect that you're talking about, the economy of scales. We're able to use our best expertise in using those funds made available to us through various programs and hiring the best brains to assist us in making decisions, to give us the options, not to tell us how to do things, but we can buy the options, get the information and the knowledge, and control of programs and how those services are delivered. We have to be able to control those systems ourselves so that they're done more efficiently. And we've proved that we've been able to do that.
Dave Case, you had a...
But is the... I think you mentioned earlier on that you were skeptical about regional IRAs, perhaps, or regional tribal governments. I'm not sure you use that term.
Authorities without the approval of the village people themselves, yes.
But jurisdiction, political authority then would be at the village level and could be delegated in certain instances to a larger regional
body. It's very similar in aspect to states' rights and federalism.
Okay, so a federation of villages could have their own institutions that would have regional-wide authority.
But more on the Canadian model, where the provinces have more authorities than the federal government in most cases and are able to make those local determinations.
So the authority would ultimately reside at the village level rather than at a regional level.
The ultimate authority has to lie with the people, yes.
Provinces own the land in Canada. Federal government doesn't. The Mary Miller.
In 1983, I bravely or naively, as the case may be, also made an effort to write about our people's future. And in a paper that I did write, I tried to take a perspective of just the average person at the local level. And what I did was try to look at what options Alaska Natives were looking at for protecting their land in the future, and then evaluating these options as to their legal feasibility, their economic feasibility, and their cultural feasibility, given the local context of each village. I identified several options that were being discussed at the time and that still are being discussed, being the Alaska Land Bank, transfer of ANCSA lands to IRA or traditional governments, corporate reorganization strategies, the possibility of land use planning, the option of mergers or consolidations, half a page on granting title to municipalities, maybe a third of a page, and the ANILCA provisions that are in place now. Since then, having worked for this will be my second year with tribal governments in the Bering Straits region, I believe that my views have become much more in favor of at least exploring the feasibility of utilizing our tribal governments in one way or the other, given the local context of each community. What we're looking at in our region now is to form some kind of regional consortium. In doing that, we would delegate no governmental authority from the villages to a regional group whatsoever. It would just be mainly to have a collective voice in addressing issues. The first thing that we want to do is provide a structure for being able to intelligently look at the feasibility and possibility of establishing some type of tribal court system in our region. We do have villages, tribal governments, who do act on Indian child welfare cases involving foster care and adoption matters. However, as this process has gone on and since the Indian Child Welfare Act has passed, we have seen how the state of Alaska is not the proper forum to be addressing these issues. We have seen that if we can establish our own system of adjudication in the field of not only child custody matters, but other civil matters, it is in our best interest to do so. And that is what we want to look at. One thing that's very, very encouraging is that we are beginning a more realistic and a more a stronger dialogue with our neighboring region, Manilok, the Kotzebue area. One of the reasons is that the jurisdictional district for the state court system covers both the Manilok and the Kuwerik areas, the Bering Straits and Nana regions. If we, at this point, we all know that the state is the one that is still handling our child custody cases. If we could establish a state-tribal agreement on the state's, the tribe's involvement, real involvement in these cases, in the absence of tribal courts, until a tribal court system can be set in place, I believe that's in our best interest. As to what Rosita was saying a minute ago about regional groups and the future of them, currently we have three villages that are contracting for services themselves. This has taken away from Kuwerik contracting for federal services from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We foresee that probably more villages will be doing the same thing. And I can proudly state that the administration of our tribal nonprofit is open to that idea and realizes that that is a real possibility.
Do the IRAs in the villages, are they the parties that contract with BIA then?
Yes. some contract for just two or three programs, some contract for more. The IRA Council in the community of Nome contracts for all of them. Another thing that we see happening is on our own, in some of, hopefully most of our communities in our region, is that the Village Corporation and the IRA Councils are starting a real dialogue about how they can work together. I see this very strong, particularly in the communities on St. Lawrence Island. I would also like to state for the record that we do have three communities who were former reservations, who at the time of the Land Claims Act opted to take the surface and subsurface title. These three communities, I believe, are at a very real advantage in making use of their tribal government. They don't have to deal with a regional corporation that claims title to the subsurface estate. And that's something that's, I believe they're very lucky to be in the situation they are in. On St. Lawrence Island, we have, the communities are starting to adopt some draft and adopt some ordinances on, for instance, on preserving what they call valuable tribal resources. They want to eliminate people coming in and buying up artifacts and the community not really benefiting, except for individuals who usually settle for a lot less than they can settle for. That's a very clear thing that's happening. It began with Gamble, and Savunga is now looking very seriously at that also. We have not really, over the past 10 or 15 years, our villages really have not come together to talk about tribal government issues as one body, one group of people. That is becoming something that is more and more needed and requested by our villages so that we can have a collective focus on issues and be able to speak in a unified voice on political issues. The last thing I would like to emphasize again is that there is a very fragmented effort when you have too many organizations or entities in one small village. People become very burnt out with holding meetings. And when you do have to change hats so often, what it does is that you are not able to provide the focus that you could if you had only one group speaking and addressing all of the issues that the villages are facing. And I can't emphasize enough the need that we have to face this dilemma head on. Our one community in our region made some effort to do that in a meeting in late October or early November, but nothing was resolved. The intent of the meeting was to just understand what the implications were of dissolving a city government. I'm glad that they at least did that, but I don't see that any real action in the near future will be taken on that issue. That's all I have right now.
Yeah, thanks, Murray. David, Case, yeah.
You mentioned the subsurface, the absence of a subsurface problem on the former reservations. What about the 14C question? How is that being handled in those communities?
I can't speak to that. I can't say. I'm not familiar enough with what they're doing with that.
Thank you. I wonder if we could. We promised to have.
I have my hand up here,
Mr. Just let me suggest how we're going to proceed. We haven't had a coffee break. I think we should have one. After the coffee break, I suggest that since Spud and Mary have opened up the question of tribal courts, that we might move on to the next item in the agenda and ask Browning Pipestem and Ralph Johnson to tell us something about the way tribal courts function in the lower 48. I think it's worth covering that particular ground this afternoon, if we can. I still have some questions that have accumulated on as we've proceeded with the discussion about supervision by the Secretary of Interior and the whole question of holding land in trust or in fee, but I'd like to still to come to those sometime today. Okay, Charlie, you're going to have the last question before we adjourn for coffee.
The question of the Secretary of Interior and the question of governmental jurisdiction. Under the January 2nd, 1976 amendment, I would like to read to you what it says and ask me if this is what it says. I would like your interpretation and your participation if this is not trust responsibility. And so I would like to get away on the assumption of termination versus termination. And the 1976 amendments to Alaska Native Land Claims on revenue sharing. The problems that we have had with State of Alaska is that the Alaska Native people need a stick, a big enough stick, to put the state on the line so that we can deal with the problems of equity and distribution fairly. And so the biggest strength that the Alaska Native people have is their ability to say no to the United States government or State of Alaska or to you, Mr. Berger. And so this, under Title 25, Section 162A, it reads, further provide that this section shall not be construed to create or terminate any trust relationship between the United States and any corporation or individual to receive the benefit under the Settlement Act. And so, what does this do for us? Does this mean that we can now transfer assets to a federal IRA? Or does this mean that we have to excuse ourselves and let racism reign in America? When tyranny by the states' rights people getting organized and here, and it further reads that if this is not enough, I don't know what is. And to the extent that there is a conflict between the provision of this section and the extent the other federal laws applicable to Alaska, the provisions of this section will govern. So it, to me, it is beyond a reasonable doubt that there is a responsibility and a function. And so the state of Alaska, all of its land entitlement came from the United States. That our political development on the North Slope is that we have a home rule government, but State of Alaska has not given us the land. So we go through this horrible process. We've spent millions and millions of dollars in court to maintain our right, And so since 1972 to this day, the North Slope Borough has not received 1 acre of land. And then here is this great state that is supposed to give these obligations to us, pass them on down to citizenship. It's been over 12 and a half years that we have not received 1 acre. So the hostility, the structural racistic hostility of the Anglo-Saxon community is real. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs is politically whip. They're a whip stick of the Anglo-Saxon community, and they're spineless to rise against these rest of these Anglo-Saxon tyrant. And here state of Alaska has not decided to share the land that it has received and to a borough government that it organized. And so the structural hostilities of the state are real. So I think that it should behoove the commission and all of the regional corporations and the village corporations that it is high time that we get the state on these problems, and the way to get the state is to utilize a recommendation made by Mr. Browning Pipestem is to utilize the 1982 Indian Revenue Act. And then we incorporate this responsibility to these areas where the revenues from oil and gas at Prudhoe Bay would be severed. And if state of Alaska is going to continuously to racistically deny the Inupiat people their land entitlements, that the permanent fund should be locked up. And once you start locking up the state's funds, they're going to start playing. So all the people here have said is all of these problems. How do they stop? They stop when you get to their money. And Alaska Native people and the people of the United States and state of Alaska get their funds from the Revenue Act. So if you're dealing with tribal government, your capital formation powers come from the land and the resources. State of Alaska is no different. It gives oil and gas leases. Tribes give oil and gas leases. But no Vinatai cannot have his oil and gas leases. So when this self-denial by the Anglo-Saxon community to deny Eskimos over here, we cannot understand that. We cannot understand why the barrier exists when it exists in when the law says otherwise. And so the section 5 on subsection 29.5, I got to read this again.
Well, you don't have to read it again. We heard it once.
Here is another section where in that same law it says that trust responsibility exists. For your benefit, I am reading this to you. The funds that we were entitled to and the entitlements of the 13th Regional Corporation and the at-large corporation, the land bank, everything that we have is tied to these numbers. And if these numbers are not dealt with at the inception from the recipients, you have to know what your numbers are. So what they have done with Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act is that they have given you a deregulation corporate activity without any government. So for the last 50 years, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Secretary of Interior has never defined our lands, and ANCSA came in, and now that we have a structural conflict, but the biggest catch-all is, but subject to valid existing rights. And those valid existing rights mean that you must have a proper accounting of your oil and of how much of the fund from the Alaska Native Fund has been received. Why this royalty accounting is of great importance to all of us here is that this is a way to attach the governor and the Secretary of Interior where it hurts. We have been abused long enough and waiting. And so when we talk about tribal configuration, yes, it is possible. It is in law. But where we have problems is in human administration. The Bureau of Indian Affairs are so swift, and the Bureau of Land Management, that since 1975 that there has been only one court-ordered town site. There are 75 native town sites. Of the 108 village entitlements and groups, 131 have never applied. So when you multiply 131 entitlements times a township, that's a lot of land. When you multiply 30,000 natives who are enrolled in the 13th Regional Corporation or on the at large, then those people who have voluntarily abandoned their tribal relationship with the blessing of the United States are entitled to 160 acres. The village corporations and the regional corporations, nor the BIA, nor State of Alaska, has never seen them to fully implement the Tribal Abandonment Act of the United States, which is Title 43, 189. If an Indian is to abandon its tribal relationship, my feeling is that he is entitled to 160 acres for becoming an American. And this is what that person is entitled to. And so these entitlements were taken off in 1976. Were taken off by FLTMA, the Native Townsite Act, the Native Allotment Act, the veterans, the whole prairie economy of America was stripped out when they took away the Homestead Act. So what happened to the Alaska Natives also happened to the white people in Alaska. The white people can no longer make these allotments. We got all wiped out in 1976. All of the American people can no longer get any public entry from public lands. What is because American people were silent in 1976 when this country was trying to determine under the Federal Land Management Policy Act of 1976, Congress saw in its wisdom that it is now going to erase all of the public land grant that it gave to the American people from now on. So from 1976 on up, Americans, citizens, have no birthright from public lands. And so it should behoove those racist organizations that want equality. I would like for them to tackle FLTMA, and then we can go to Congress jointly and say that he too was a victim, that bigoted, racist, hunter, extraordinary. So what happened to us, and why we are quibbling over the spoils is we have not yet fully received the benefit that was promised to us in ANCSA because we have delayed it with FLIPMA, we have delayed it with other techniques, and yet on paper, oh, you're not terminating. You're not terminating. But that BIA, oh, we have a question. I'm sorry, we're going to delay this contract because we're not sure. We're not sure what Congress had intended. So therefore, that they sit on you. And so the developments that we are facing with here and the agonizing process that ANCSA is, and it is an agonizing process, and those of us, we would like to see an accounting of what is due today. Say, in my area, we had organized the Inupiat Community of the Arctic as a way to protect as our reaction against ANCSA, on the bad of ANCSA. And so we found out that was not good enough, so the next line of defense was the North Slope Borough. So all of our defenses are easing off, and then so that was not enough. So we had to create a new complete jurisdiction within the American administration called the Arctic Science Policy. The Arctic Science Policy is an administrative unit within the United States doctrine, and the boundaries of Arctic are defined. So when you are, when the Alaska Native people are absent, that does not mean that all tribes are absent. So the Arctic Slope have been busy working with itself, and we now have a new administrative unit which Mr. Reagan has signed into law, which is a national policy dealing with the Arctic. And these lands are not in U.S. jurisdiction. They are now in a new definition. And I will read to you this new definition, this new American administration.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. I really share the frustration that Charlie is
expressing. The definition of the word Arctic.
Let Rosita say a word.
Excuse me, I have the floor.
Now let Rosita say a word, please.
Mr. Chairman, I share the same frustrations that Charlie is expressing, and I would suggest that perhaps that the commission get together with Charlie and maybe sit down and listen to him. However, at this point in time, we have invited people from all around the world. We have experts from many different areas. I would like to have the benefit of, and I'm sure that there are others who would like to have the benefit of hearing from the other seven people who are scheduled to be on the agenda today. I would like to have the opportunity to hear them. I would like to have the opportunity for myself and others to ask them questions. And I would suggest that we get together with Etook at a later time.
Let's drop for coffee, Charlie, and let's have a conversation.
It's better to have a discourse than it is bullets.
Well, look, I'm going to adjourn this for coffee, and I'll talk to you about when you can make this presentation, but you can't simply take up the time of everybody here on something that isn't really germane to our agenda. So we'll adjourn for coffee now. Just before we move on to tribal courts, Chris McNeil wanted to say something.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Does this mic work? Wanted to say that I've certainly appreciated this discussion that we've had here today, especially in looking at the especially in looking at and talking about the various powers of tribal government. And it seems to me there's been a lot of work done and in the past, and which substantially defines the range of the powers of tribal governments. But if I had my ears tuned halfway right, I thought I heard a couple people saying that to some degree tribal governments are also defined in a specific context, and that context in, to some degree defines the meets and bounds of the exercise of those powers. It strikes me that here in the state of Alaska, that in looking at some of those questions, that you have to also look at some of the broader impacts that are out there right now and things that we foresee. And it strikes me that one of the things that is important is that in this state, of course, the oil revenues have been tremendous and have generated tremendous revenue streams throughout the state. In addition to that, apparently the forecasts are that those revenue streams will diminish sometime in the early 1990s. At this point, through the state legislative process, Alaska Natives do obtain some benefit of the generation of state revenues. Another thing about that is it seems to me it does raise a question, is that as we're looking at the question of the tribal governments, and especially in rural Alaska, what impact there may be insofar as the use and generation of those revenues, insofar as what would be available under different circumstances. Another thing that seems, at least strikes me as somewhat important, is that the state, the demographics of the state, of course, is changing considerably. 1990 will come around and there will be another census, and of course there is always the potential and possibility that there could be a significant political realignment insofar as the manner in which this state is run, the impact of the rural areas on the policy formation at the state level, and of course 1991 itself. One of the reasons that I was thinking about the impact of state revenues is a comment that was made, I think, earlier by Browning related to the balance sheet of tribal government, I think he called it. And it strikes me as a very important thing to talk about, because you really do have to have some form of capital formation, it seems, to be able to make these tribal governments work. That is to say, even if everybody agrees on what those tribal governments ought to be, and you also assume that we would be able to have what we want, nevertheless, it will take something to run it. And I don't know what the answers are, but it seems to me that as you're looking at how you form those, that there has to be a lot of thought given to the manner in which those tribal governments would be, funded or would operate. The reason that I was thinking that is because in the definition of the meets and bounds of the authorities of a tribal government, you can talk about a lot of things that it could do, including, you know, education and police powers and judicial powers, regulatory powers related to the environment, fish and game management, employment opportunities. But the more you talk about those things, the more it strikes me anyway that what you're talking about are even larger infusions of money in some form or another that would have to deal with a rise in expectations about a tribe itself. And I don't think any of this is impossible, but I don't know what the answer to that is, but it just seems to me that even if we had in its purest form all the authorities and so forth that we think exist and should be recognized by the federal and state governments, that there still would be those nuts and bolts kinds of problems of making the whole thing work. And I
And I think the question of capital formation is really a critical one in that context. And I think it's even more critical when you look at, for example, the ANCSA village corporations who are there, who are supposedly dealing with a fairly narrow frame of reference, and that is the maintenance of the assets that were conveyed by the Claim Settlement Act and attempting to make a profit. Even doing that, of course, we all know that many of those village corporations, for all intents and purposes, don't operate, and that, in fact, there even had to be some a little bit of finagling around at the state level to make sure that they weren't, cease to be recognized as operating entities by the state government. In looking at the overall situation with tribal governments, I can't help but think of one of the themes that runs through a lot of the operations with ANCSA corporations today, especially, and that is a question of the expectations that you generate as to what you can and what you can't do. I really think that in a lot of ways the native corporations had just tremendous expectations of them, generated over at least several generations, wherein a lot of our forefathers thought that if only we'd get this land claim settlement that everything would be okay, and that in some sense we'd live happily ever after. Well, we all know that that didn't occur, and to some extent maybe we've expected too much of it. But the reason I bring this up is because in looking at tribal governments, it strikes me that we have to be at least a little bit cautious as to the expectations issue there too, because if it's built up to be maybe something way more than it could ever deliver, the possibility is at least there that three or four or five years after it was clearly implemented or recognized, however it occurred, that what you might have are again tribal members coming forward and being somewhat unhappy that maybe it can't do everything that people thought it could or should do. And I do that. I'm talking here mostly to raise the issue. I surely don't have any answers to it, but I really think that these are some of the things that one maybe ought to be thinking about a little bit, insofar as in effect defining the meets and bounds of what it ought to be, because I think there can be maybe nothing more frustrating, especially in our case for shareholders of the corporation, than feeling that in some way that they've been ripped off because they're not getting what they thought they were going to get. And I think that risk is also here insofar as looking at tribal governments.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. I think that Charles Wilkinson?
I will be very brief, but I'd like to use that opportunity to explain a point I made earlier. I think I emphasized yesterday that tribal sovereignty is profound, and that it's a worldwide movement. And I ascribed Browning's characterization that it's magic. I think it is. Earlier, I said that the system in the lower 48 isn't magic. In other words, the form of tribal sovereignty in the lower 48 reservation system isn't magic. What we have to realize is that you can take the ideal of tribal sovereignty and put it in many different forms. Perhaps the most pure form is in the form of international sovereignty, where an Indian tribe would be something akin to a nation. Then you have the form in the lower 48 where you have the Indian country concept. You also have tribal sovereignty in the fashion that it's exerted in a somewhat informal way without formal legal protections up here in Alaska. But I think Chris is absolutely right in saying that just moving the Indian country idea up here may not be the best form for tribal sovereignty. And two quick examples that I will give is that many tribes in the lower 48 are looking to Alaska because many of your corporations